Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome to Tremendous Life Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate you tuning in. We have a wonderful guest tonight, real excited. We have Ms. Melody Beatty back on the show with us. Melody is a beloved best-selling author. She's an advocate for recovery and healing. She's a household name for recovery all over the place. She introduced the world to the term codependency in 1986 with her work Codependent No More. And since then, she's shared a ton of her experience and her wisdom, 15 plus books. She's writing all the time, bringing value all the time. And she's really been a good friend to me and to Tremendous Life Radio. And we're excited to have her back. Melody, welcome back to Tremendous Life Radio.
Thank you so very much for inviting me. I just love really... doing a show with you. It's always fun.
Well, thank you. I love having you, believe me. So, and thanks for taking time out. Let's get started right away. I mean, you've been on the show before and you talked about your early years, things that shaped you. And that's what we usually like to, hear from our guests on this show. Maybe you can give us just a digested version of that. What was going on with you in your early years?
In my early years, which ones? It's like what it was like, what happened, and what happened next. And then what it was like, what happened, and what happened after that. There is no end to the lessons in life that we can be learning if we want to. You know, we can walk around, we can ignore them, or we can try and figure out what we're supposed to be learning when we go through it. And much as I would like to avoid pain, I don't know that it's possible in life. But I've also learned that we don't have to be in as much pain as we are. You know, there are answers to our problems. I started out, anyway, I'll go back to what you asked. I was an alcoholic by the time I was 11, 12 years old. I'm talking about drinking every day, blackout drinking. I had had a pretty awful childhood between repeat illnesses that would take me out of school and put me to bed for a year, being abducted and molested when I was 4 years old. I was kidnapped and molested. And the police had to come and find me. So there was a lot of trauma, but we didn't talk about those things back then. And the world certainly wasn't ready for an 11-year-old girl that got straight A's in school but was also an alcoholic. We didn't realize that young kids could be addicts and alcoholics then. When I was 18, I made a decision to stop drinking and just use drugs instead because I could see that I had an extremely volatile relationship with alcohol and it made me crazy when I drank it. So I switched to drugs, but that wasn't the solution either. By the time I was 24 years old, we didn't have treatment then either. I couldn't check myself into a treatment center because we're so lucky to have all this information out there. If there's one thing I've learned through all my what it was like and what happened, it's that more than, and I wish someone would have told me that this when I went through treatment finally, that life is a series of solving problems. Just like writing. I was told that about writing. You know, writing is just a series of solving problems. So is life. But nobody prepared me for it. I mean, it might be basic, but I didn't know that. And I didn't trust my ability to solve problems. That was something very important that I needed to learn. And the problem I faced when I went through treatment was acknowledging that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. It wasn't working, my relationship with drugs and alcohol, and it took me 8 months in treatment. The state of Minnesota graciously gave me a choice. I could go to prison or I could go to treatment. And I had to think about it. I had to actually think about my answer because to me, drugs and alcohol had been, up to that time, my only connection to good feelings in life. And when I thought about losing that relationship, I thought, I'm going to lose everything I am. To me, it looked like dying. I found out, though, that recovery isn't about losing who we are. It's a process of taking who we are and using our gifts, our personality traits for good in life. And it became very clear to me very quickly after I got put in treatment that drugs and alcohol weren't good for me. I hadn't been choosing to use, like I conned myself into believing. I couldn't control whether or not I used. That's when I started turning to my higher power, and I got sober. It really stunned me. I had a distinct spiritual experience in treatment, and I loved being there then. It kind of became like college or home. I got out of treatment. I did all the right things. I waited 2 years before I worked in treatment. I took college courses in becoming a counselor. And I also met a man that had supposedly been clean and sober. He was an alcoholic for several years. He was in the media all the time. He was doing a lot of work with alcoholics and drug addicts. Treatment had begun by then, and it was a blooming industry. You know, people were talking about it. People liked the idea that alcoholics and addicts could be fixed, both the alcoholics and addicts and their families. And so treatment was a big deal back then, and it was in the news all the time, and so was the man that I ended up marrying and had two children with. I got it wrong, though. He wasn't really sober. It took me 7 years of marriage to him before I finally realized, you know, I just had such low self-esteem. Like if anyone said, what are you talking about? You're wrong. I believed him. It just went with my low self-esteem. And after 7 years, by then I was working in a treatment center. I had been married for seven painful years. They were good years, though. I had my babies. I had my children. Before I learned he wasn't clean and sober, he had never been. He had been lying to me through the whole marriage. He'd been having affairs. I just didn't trust myself enough to believe in myself and what I thought and felt and wanted. And that began my journey to understand codependency. When I went to work at the treatment center, I was all excited. I thought, oh, I'm going to get a caseload. I'm going to be able to work with addicts. But instead, they sent me to work with the family groups. They wanted me to work with the families. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't want to do with them. They said, we don't either. You're new here. It's your job. But then I got curious. I do love a good challenge. And I started searching for information, and there was so very little. Everything then for the families was about how to help the alcoholic. Well, I was exhausted from trying to help the alcoholic by then. I needed to find a way that I could heal, that I could get better. And I had my bottoming out with codependency, too. It was a weekend. I didn't have my own car then. And whenever I would get a car, my husband would manage to crash it or do something with it or leave it after a drinking binge. So I was pretty much barefoot and pregnant and no phone. But I did have a phone at that time. He came home one Thursday from work and said, honey, I've got a chance to go to Vegas. You don't mind, do you? And I was thinking, we've never been on a vacation. We're broke. The guy's going to Vegas. He got to be kidding me. But I didn't have enough confidence to say what I thought and felt. So I said, oh, sure, honey, that's fine. Just promise me you won't drink. Come on. So we had a big party plan for that weekend. I had a neighbor that had put, she's the one that got me into Elena. And I was putting on a graduation party for her. She had put herself through nursing school and was graduating, and my husband had promised to help. I had 83 people coming to the house on Sunday. He was supposed to be home Friday night. Well, of course, he never came home. And then the next phone call from him I got, I heard a glug, glug, glug in the background. He hung up on me, and he never picked up the phone again. And I kept thinking, if I could just get him home, if I could just get him to listen to me, you know, then it would be all right. And with 83 people coming the next day, I sat trying to get that man to pick up the phone in his hotel room, calling him over and over and over from about 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 10 o'clock that night, just dialing and dialing and dialing with this frantic obsession that if I could just get him to listen to me, everything would be all right. And finally, after years of this insanity, the lights came on for me, and I thought, no, it's not going to be all right if he listens to me, if he comes home. This problem is bigger than that. I can't control it. And this is this dialogue I'm having with myself, or awareness. And I thought, what he's doing is really crazy because he's burning his marriage. And I thought, what I'm doing is pretty crazy too. I have 83 people coming tomorrow. My house isn't ready. The food isn't ready. And what have I done? I've sat at this phone and dialed the same number over and over and over all day. And that's began my journey into understanding codependency recovery and true self-care. How do you take care of yourself with someone who's lying to you, who seemingly doesn't care about losing his family, and someone who doesn't want your help? I mean, what do you do? How do you handle a person like that? And the answer, the only answer I could find, is in taking care of myself. And I don't mean that narcissistically. I don't mean, you know, self-pampering, sitting 8 by month. I mean, take responsibility for myself, responsibility for how I feel, what I want, for setting my own boundaries about what I'll put up with, what I won't put up with. And it really is an exciting journey. It's different than with addiction, where your focus is on not doing something anymore. Codependency recovery is about starting to do something, take care of ourselves. And I got to tell you, that feels really good after a lifetime of not doing it. It's a lot more fun than recovery from addiction.
Yeah. And I heard so much. I mean, you just shared a ton in that digest version there. You know, I mean, I have questions I want to ask you. And as, it's tough for me as I'm listening because I'm just captivated and I think of things, but I want to listen. So it's sometimes things slip by me. You know, it's wild. So, I mean, you talk about a ton of stuff and you mentioned words like self-esteem or low self-value and, you know, your insanity in doing all that. And finally, that I guess there was awakening there on that phone, dialing that same number over and over again. I mean, at that point, you probably all already learning, you know, through experience a lot more about codependency than you really signed up for, right? I mean, you weren't really aware exactly what was going on as you were learning those things, correct?
We didn't understand codependency back then. Mm-hmm. The word wasn't, there might have been a couple small groups of people, you know, pockets of 4 or 8 people that were talking about. They had a whole bunch of words for it, and none of them better than codependency. Mm-hmm. I mean, they called them enablers. They had other words. Codependence never got a word. I don't like the word codependency. It doesn't, it's a word that doesn't mean anything. I mean, I can't put my head around it. Even if you go to a 12-step group like Al-Anon, it's the only 12-step group where they don't have a name for the people who attend. Overeaters are overeaters. That says something, right? You understand it. Right. Addicts, alcoholics, you understand it. They don't have a name. If you go to an Al-Anon meeting, you just say, "Hi, my name is Melody, and I'm in Al-Anon."
Yeah.
I mean, we are as invisible in our recovery as we were in our acting out. And it's not something that's our fault. Codependency is very much a learned survival behavior. But it's a behavior that doesn't work long-term.
And I mean, isn't it, you know, for all the guests that are on the show, because this isn't really a recovery show. We talk about a lot of things about getting better and finding ourselves and bringing more value and, you know, getting that, getting right with ourselves, things like that, you know, but it's, if the guests could really get information across, and like you have, but it's how to be proactive in that. And it sounds like, and from what I've heard from you before, that it, through your experience, you had to feel all this stuff to learn it. You can't just kind of almost just know it. I guess some people do. Did you ever meet anybody that really wasn't turning their life and their will over to another person or trying to control other people out there that don't have some bit of it?
I mean, I think, And it's good in some ways, but I think not necessarily low self-esteem, but an openness to the idea that I might be wrong. I tend to think, well, I did worse at that than anyone else did, but the longer I'm sober and then the longer I was taking care of myself and actively trying to not be codependent, the more predominant I saw that behavior was. We really went through a paradigm shift in the 80s. We redefined relationships because up till that time, a good wife did what a good wife did. She never said no. She didn't make problems. She took care of her family. And there's nothing wrong with taking care of your family. That's not what's wrong. It's only wrong if it's not a choice we've made, if we feel like we have to. And I don't mean with our children. If we have children, that is our responsibility. You know, and if we're not going to take care of them, we have no business with them. Absolutely no business with them. So there's something, and that's not, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not talking about selfishness. I'm not talking about not loving and caring about people. I'm not talking about not nurturing people. I'm talking about letting ourselves have some of that too, some of the good stuff, some of the love, some of the nurturing, considering what we feel, setting appropriate boundaries instead of complaining about it, not being in prison in our own bodies anymore. You know, we just got through 4th of July weekend, and I don't remember this country the way it was before it began because I wasn't here. I think of Independence Day truly in terms of both of my recoveries, the day I got clean and sober and the day of that phone call when my husband was in Vegas and I began my journey to true freedom. Because if we're waking up every day and going to bed at night and feel like we can't set boundaries, we can't say what we feel, we can't say what we think, we don't have any say in our lives, we're in prison, whether we're in prison or not. And for me, recovery from codependency meant the door to the prison I had been in for almost all of my life finally got opened. You know, I could say what I had to say, I could be honest about who I was, I didn't have to constantly try and disguise or downgrade myself. And it is so freeing to be able to do that. You know, some of these new behaviors we learn, whether it's setting a boundary. There was a person that I've had to set a boundary with even recently. I no longer find it impossible to say what I want in a relationship. We can't make people do anything. But if a relationship is, for whatever reason, so toxic for us that we can't function in it, it's our job to end the relationship. We don't have to be mean. I told this woman, I'm not mad. It's not about me needing to forgive you. It's none of that. But you need to get better before you can be in my life as a friend.
Hey, you mentioned, and thank you, Melody, you mentioned the Independence Day piece and the freedom. We know when you were on the phone dialing that number and over again, think back to there if you would, you didn't realize that insanity was going to, and that hopeless feeling or whatever the feelings were, the words that are put to it, were going to be really the catalyst for some of the greatest things in your life, right? It's kind of ironic.
No,
right?
I mean, I was just starting to learn about the magic in life because to me, when I'm aware, when I'm trying consciously to live my life by the values that are important to me, life is magical. And I think one of the worst things that can happen to us as people is when life loses its magic for whatever reasons. When we start to think that there's no rhyme or reason to life, there's no purpose, there is so much rhyme and reason to every human being's life. We just have to open up to it. I mean, it's there. We'll find that we get the situations we need. We'll find that we get just what we need. We might be stuck on a problem and the answer will come out of nowhere. That doesn't mean that every single thing is meant to be. We have to use our powers of judgment and decision-making too. But yes, it is very, very much an experiential experience living our lives. We can't do it from our head. We can't do it by reading a book. We need to be in our lives and experience whatever's happening, trusting that it is going to work out for good. Does it mean we'll get what we want?
Hey, what about, early on, I'm guessing now, and I may be wrong, you know, I've listened to you before, but those early times when the change started happening or you made those decisions or you started reading and studying and starting to learn more about yourself, and I'm sure through inventories, but were there times you had to sort through the, I'm a victim, you know, and blaming everybody else? I mean, how did you really get the focus back on you, you know, to be free? I mean, can you even put that into words?
The focus came back on me the day of that phone call, because for the first time since I married an alcoholic, I saw myself instead of him. It's so easy to find the flaws in other people. I mean, it's really easy. It's a lot harder to find them in ourselves and then correct them. It really, I don't know why that is. It's just so easy to see what other people should fix about themselves.
I asked about the being proactive. I mean, even in your description up to that point, I mean, it sounds to me like you just got sick of it. Like that was it. Like, I'm just can't do this anymore. This isn't working. And you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah. With the codependency, that rang loud and clear. The addiction recovery was pretty well forced on me, but I'm so grateful it happened. I mean, we don't have to like the things that happen right away. I think it's important to stay open from them and sort out, you know, what does this mean to me? Why is this happening? Is there something I can learn from this experience that will make my life better, that will give me another set of tools or skills for learning life? What am I supposed to do? We can run into some problems that we think are never going to get solved, that like, oh, it's the end. It's the absolute end, and this is never going to work out. This is the most powerful tool I have ever been given in life, is the power of gratitude. Not gratitude for the good things. A monkey's grateful for a banana. It's no great shakes to be grateful for the good things. I'm talking about practicing gratitude for everything that happens in our life. And we don't have to cheapen tragedy by doing it. It's an exercise. I wrote about it in Make Miracles in 40 Days. And it is the ability to just stop when we panic. I'll give you a very specific story. I was taking care of my mother when she was dying from Alzheimer's disease. I live in California now. She lived in Minnesota. I was flying back every month to, you know, and set up a system where she could be cared for. I was actually getting ready to move in with her in the North Woods of Minnesota when she died. And anyway, because I had to fly from California to Minnesota and then I had to drive up north, I bought a condo close to the airport, just a small place that I furnished in a good neighborhood. And that way I could take the red eye in, catch a good night's sleep, and then drive up to my mom's. Or if I had to do paperwork or something, I could go back to my condo and do it. It was just a nice, safe house. I bought that in 2003, right before the housing market dropped. So after my mother's death, I went to sell it, and no way could I sell it then. I mean, I didn't have enough equity in the house to even cover the mortgage at the time, or in the condo. So I waited. I rented it out for a while, and finally last year, I decided I'd sell it. And this is another example of problem-solving and gratitude. So I got the place already. I found a great real estate agent in Minneapolis. We got the place all ready to sell. And then we found a buyer. And then I discovered, when on the day of closing, I didn't fly back to Minnesota, thank God, but on closing day, found out that one of the owners in the condo complex, there's probably 300 units, had filed some frivolous lawsuit against the condo association for some repair work done on her roof. I mean, five condos wouldn't cost as much as she was suing the association for. And it had gone on and on because she was acting as her own attorney and wasn't an attorney. And the condo association wasn't doing anything about it. Nobody in that whole building could sell their units unless they found an all-cash buyer. And I didn't find that out until, I think it was 5 weeks ago. And so I called up the association and I said, this could go on for 9 years, because their stance is, we're not going to hire an attorney and do anything because we don't want to pay the money. So that meant nobody could sell their condo in the whole building until this lawsuit gets expired. Because when you're applying for a mortgage, if there is a lawsuit against the property, it's locked up. You can't sell it. No one will give you a mortgage for it. I haven't despaired. I don't mean I was running around screaming, crying, but I just, the bottom fell out. I went, I don't want to own that condo for another 10 years. I was actually hoping to buy a different place in L.A. I'm finishing my script, and I would like to live closer to the studios. But I don't want all those houses on my credit rating at the same. I mean, that's a lot of houses. So I didn't know what to do. I mean, I'm in a problem. Someone's telling you it could go on for 9 years. You can't sell your condo unless you find a cash buyer. Well, that's a very small market they're talking about. I took a deep breath and I thought, why don't I practice what I preach? And so I deliberately, I did just as I had said in the book, and I started practicing gratitude for the situation, just as it is. I learned this back in 1978. And instead of spending my energy negatively, you know, why is this happening? It'll never get fixed, blah, blah, blah. I turned it into gratitude. I'm grateful I might never sell the place. I'm grateful that it looks like I might not sell it for 9 years. I'm grateful that the problem seems unsolvable right now. I'm grateful for everything in my life just as it is right now. It was actually on my birthday. It was supposed to sell, so that was May 26th. And it looked absolutely hopeless then. I just got an email from the real estate agent. After I called the condo manager, apparently, I don't know, I might have mentioned something about, has anyone contacted the media? I wouldn't do it. If I do have any extra powers, I don't do that. That, to me, would be mean. But I just mentioned it. Well, anyway, a week later, the condo association finally did something. I did talk to an attorney out here, a condo attorney, and he said, you know, maybe get a comfort letter from the association, you know, and then someone might give them a mortgage. But nobody had any hope about it. The gratitude, the email I got yesterday said that with this new letter and new things that the association has done, they have now finally begun approving mortgages, and my place should sell in 2 weeks. I mean, should close. I mean, 2 months ago it was hopeless, and it went from hopeless to, I don't want to assume it's going to happen on the day I say that I know anything that's going to happen, but I'm not obsessing about it. I'm not despairing about it. It looks pretty bright right now.
Yeah. And it was 2 months ago. That's a wild example. I mean, I'm glad. That's a wonderful story. That when you were telling yourself those things and really practicing the gratitude that you described, did you believe it?
And I wasn't doing it with any expectation of how it would turn out. Because I don't know how it's supposed to turn out. Mm-hmm. You know, I can wish for the best, but I don't know that. I was just doing it, being in the moment, and just doing the discipline of gratitude for everything as it is in my life today, which is really bottom line, acceptance with faith.
Hey, how long did it take you to come to the conclusion that maybe you ought to practice what you preach?
Not long. It was really only about 2 hours. And I do think it is, I mean, I had to feel negative before I could realize it was a problem. And we do need to feel our feelings. That's really important. And I do catch on pretty soon. I would say I don't go to bed before I figured out what I should be doing, or I try not to.
Well, that's from years of intentional practicing those things, though. I mean,
if I'm not learning better at my age, I never will. You know, if I haven't gotten some things by now. You know?
Well, and that's what excites me about the title, at least the subtitle of Beyond Codependency, that getting better all the time. What you're talking about right now is describing those things, right? And really with practical, applicable steps, you share your experience.
Right, with tools. We need, again, I'm going to get back to that same thing. Life is a series of solving problems. Mm-hmm. Just like writing, what do I need to do right now? First, what is the problem? And second, what do I need to do to solve it? Mm-hmm. Is it something within myself? Is it taking action out there in the world? Is there something I need to learn? Is this experience trying to teach me something? I wish for everyone listening that the magic comes back to their lives. It's so easy to start thinking that life is random, that there's no reason. We all used to believe that everything happens for a reason, and things do, and there's two reasons. This overall spiritual growth reason, and then many things happen because someone did or didn't do something. You know, there's a human cause and effect, and then the spiritual reason. But very much everything that does happen happens for a reason. It's not too reassuring when we tell people that. It's something we need to discover for ourselves.
Well, and again, there you said it's experiential. That's the, we can't really read that in a book. I don't know if we can, I mean, we can be reminded, I guess, or be kind of fertile soil to learn it when we feel it. But, you know, it seems to me that for most of us, I know certainly in my life, that until I've experienced those things, I just couldn't know it, you know? And it sounds right. like a lot of the same for you.
Right. I mean, experiential learning is the best. I mean, if we can read a map once in a while and, like, avoid driving to really bad places where we don't need to be, that's helpful. I mean, there's times we can just choose to go around a negative experience. And sometimes we find ourselves in it for no fault of our own. And even getting better, if we could look at that not as we're sick and we're really messed up and I've got to get better, but no, I can keep learning and growing. I can feel happier. There seems to be a national malady of unhappiness going around for about the last 20 years, where people are very depressed. People have life has lost the magic. They don't see a lot of reason in their lives. And we can't find happiness. I mean, if we go out and look for happiness, I can guarantee you we're not going to find it. But we can begin to create it. We can create it by the way we think. There's always in the back of our minds this voice going. But if we are distracted by cell phones and emails and a lot of noise around us, we're not going to hear that voice. It's a voice that can best be heard in meditation and quiet times where we really become aware of how we think about things. Most of us have been programmed. This voice is programmed the same way we feed a program into our computers. And if we're using our programming to decide how happy we're going to be, like, oh, I hate going there. That's such a pain. I dread going there. Oh, not this again. If we talk that way, if we think that way, how are we going to feel? If there's constant negative chatter going on inside of us, we can change that chatter, though. We can absolutely change that chatter, but only if we become aware of it. You know, we become aware of the problem to fix, and then we can fix it. Sometimes maybe something really bad did happen, and it stressed us out horribly. Maybe we've even got PTSD, where, you know, we've had a very traumatic experience, and we're still rebounding from that. We can still change the way we think. We can ask ourselves, is there a problem right now I need to fix? And if there isn't, if we've just let this old programming take over and let that old programming decide how we're going to feel every day, we're probably not going to feel all that great. If we're looking for happiness, we're not going to find it. If we're actively creating it, we can definitely get better, and we can all create more happiness in our lives.
And Melody, that's the hit, I think, really. And we're talking about that. Actually, Mr. Shad Helmstetter, he wrote a book. He's been on the show. Interesting about what to say when you talk to yourself. And it's kind of the kind of things you're talking about there. And, you know, I'm certainly a layman. I'm not a scientist. I'm kind of a run-of-the-mill guy, you know. But when what you were saying, and as I was listening to you, it is that on purpose, talking to ourselves differently, you know, and realizing, I guess, and that's the piece, that's the rub, right? First, we almost have to feel discomfort before we can look in a different direction.
Figure out what needs to be fixed. Yeah.
Ask better questions. That's just a tough piece, you know, but that I imagine from my own life so far and from listening to people like you, that's kind of the way it works. So the next thing is, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do? You know, and I guess some people stay unhappy. Well, there's lots of reasons, I guess, you know, they don't have a purpose. You talk about that, you know, a purpose and to create happiness, to create joy, to share our stories with other people, to share our pain and to share our successes and how we move through things. And you've been doing that for, I don't know, you're not that old, but probably 40 years or so, right?
A long time. Well, I mean, the whole idea of sharing, we can't be happy if we're not sharing. I mean, who wants to eat Thanksgiving dinner alone?
Yeah.
You know, it's caring is part of happiness. Getting better doesn't mean we stop caring about people. We need to care about people to be happy in life, but we need to care about ourselves too.
Mm-hmm. And you are an advocate, strong on it. I'm sorry.
What?
Well, you're a strong advocate in that, about taking care of ourselves. And I'm sure people misconstrue your message, or maybe not, but I would guess so, you know, that if we don't really take a look at that and inventory ourselves and look at where we are individually, you know, at least for myself, you know, the message can sound like, well, it's all about you. And that's probably the opposite of that, correct?
Right. I mean, the purpose of getting better or getting happier isn't to live a life of isolation. It doesn't, the program I work doesn't work unless we actively share it. Anything mm-hmm. we have, we need to share. We use it or lose it, mm-hmm. pretty much the way it goes. But we also need to share to begin creating some happiness in our life. I hate the idea of rules, though, because there is not a list of rules that I have for people. The only rules I have are: don't hurt yourself and don't hurt anyone else. Do not physically harm yourself. Do not physically harm anyone else, and don't let anyone else hurt you. You know, if you're in a situation like that, get out of it right now. That is a no-brainer. Find a way to get out. No one deserves to be intentionally hurt by anyone else, including themselves. Other than that, there aren't any rules, because we're too individual. When I say life is about giving to others, there's a time in their lives when many people with codependency issues need to stop giving for a while, because what they've been doing is giving out of guilt. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm a horrible person if I don't do this. That's not the kind of giving I'm talking about. I'm talking about a free-spirited, generous giving that we're giving because it's what we want to do. And it's the same way with our careers, with anything else. What do we want? How can I create more happiness with myself? Getting a job you like is one way to do it. I mean, if you work at something you like, you can't lose. Right. Because you get to be happy all the time you're working.
That's, you know, and we've all heard, or maybe not, but the saying, you know, you find a job you love and you never work a day in your life, those kind of things, you know, and it's what you're talking about. So, and, you know, I had a mentor of mine that really busted me. I never thought about it, like many things, until I get it presented to me, you know. He said, Todd, you're complaining about your job. God created you to do one thing, and until you find that, this was his opinion, you know, until you seek that out and find that, you're going to always be uncomfortable and unhappy. And I said, yeah. And he said, but what about the guy that God created that's supposed to have that job? You're in his way too. And boy, I got busted. I thought, oh my gosh, I never thought about the other. There you have it, right? I never thought about the other guy, you know? So those kind of lessons, it's interesting that you talk about it. Those kind of lessons come to me. Usually they sting when I get them. Guys talk to me pretty upfront.
Yeah, I mean, the insights that come, it really does help the rest of the world if we take care of ourselves. Believe me, the rest of the world will benefit. A happier us means a happier world.
Hey, can you describe, like, when you started really studying codependency or becoming more free or deciding that maybe you can get better all the time? Were there any kind of like aha moments or catalysts when you got really on fire? I mean, I can hear it in your voice even tonight, you know, the joy. Were there times when you thought, man, this could get wild? Like, there's a lot in here. We could really change the world, you know? Did you have any of those kind of moments?
I actually thought when I wrote Codependent No More, I thought I would be lucky if 900 other people could identify with me. What I knew, this is what I believed. I believed I had a small idea that I had a great deal of passion for. Because by then I had learned that not to write a book unless I had a lot of passion for the idea. It didn't have to be a big idea, but it had to be the idea that resonated most passionately with me. I didn't write that book for money. I got a $500 advance. I wrote it because I had an enormous passion to write that book, even if 900 other people were all that needed to read it. Some people say, I don't care if just one person reads this book, that'll be enough for me. Well, it won't be enough for your publisher. You're not going to read it again.
Where did the 900 come from? What was that? Where did that number
come from? I have no idea. I know where it came from. I do. The first book I wrote, I think it sold 900 copies.
There you go. There you have it.
So I decided then, I learned then, not to have put any expectations on what I write, other than do I have enough passion to do this?
Right.
Is this what I want to be writing about? But no expectations of any kind of great things happening. And I've always believed that if I focused on growing constantly as a writer, and if I wrote well enough, my work would sell. You know, I'd be able to make a living at it. What we believe is so, so very important. I learned a lot of lessons from the stupid little brain-stimulating video games you can play on a computer. I can start playing a game that I don't even understand how to play it when I begin. The minute I change my expectations and my attitude, am I going to stay at this? Do I believe I can learn it? Or am I cutting myself by, oh, it's no use? How am I thinking about this? It makes all the difference in the world. And so I noticed that, which came in very handy. With the new 40 years old, the new 50, the new 60, the new 70, the new 80, and the new 90, most people are going to need two careers in their lifetime, unless they want to work at the same career for 70 years. An early retirement, what are you going to do, retire and do nothing? That does not sound like a recipe for happiness to me.
No, not at all.
People need to believe that whatever situation they're facing, they can do it, especially if it's what they're meant to do. They can. And what we believe is so important. What we believe about other people is so important. I found the Southern Poverty Law Center puts out, they have a website, and it teaches about prejudices and biases, and we all have them. We may know what's politically correct. That doesn't mean we don't have some bias and prejudice in us. They have a great test you can take that quickly measures where your hidden prejudices are, so we can start to become conscious of those. So anyway, after I took the test and I found out and started thinking about what are my prejudices, what are my biases in life, and I found some. I had two incidents that happened. One, at the grocery store where I shop for my groceries, there is one cashier that everyone avoids. She is always just so unpleasant and unhappy to other people. I tried this experiment with her. I thought, what if I picture her with a beautiful heart and a beautiful spirit and forget about what people think about her and just worry about what I think about her? And so I did this. You know, I deliberately just thought wonderful things about this woman. She smiles at me. She stops me in line, asks me how I'm doing, make jokes with me. This woman is so different with me than... And I proved it to someone that didn't even believe it. I showed them. And it's not because I'm smart or special. It's because I try and be aware of not locking into other people's programming. This can work with any, like, group or people we're prejudiced against. What we believe about them impacts their lives, whether we're aware of that or not. We can test out that theory. You can test it out all you want. Go to the grocery store. Go in there thinking, oh, I hate this group of people. Walk around thinking that. You'll see their heads lowered. They won't look at you. They won't look you in the eye. And then go in there another day with the belief that you love that whatever group that is that you have a bias against. Change your thinking. You will see, you can measurably see the difference in how people respond to you. What we believe about people very much affects them, affects how they behave, affects what they believe about themselves. I mean, We might think we're alone, but that's an illusion. We are all connected, whether we believe that or not. We really are. And so again, I say, our happiness affects the happiness of others. Our thoughts affect how other people think about themselves and about the world. It matters. What we think matters, not just to us, but to other people. But we have to take the time then to become aware of our beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there you go. You just gave us another actionable, even if we want to do it as an experiment. That's why you bring a lot of value here, Melody. Another thing to do. I don't know if I'm going to rush off to the grocery store right now, but you know, I'm, you know, that impacts
it's
me, you know, and
a very simple experiment that we can do. What's really great is if we then, after we experiment with it and see that it works, we can take that attitude, you know, into our lives. We don't want to be fools either. We don't want to let someone rip us off. I'm not talking about doing anything foolish. I'm talking about taking responsibility for ourselves. And our thoughts are so much more important than most of us know. What we think and what we believe about others and ourselves, about life, about what we
and in the process, we're getting better all the time, right?
We're getting better all the time, and we're helping create a happier world.
That's right.
I'm telling you, test out how people respond to your thoughts, and you will see that the more you smile, the more around you, the more the world around you smiles too.
Oh, yeah.
And that's
I can hear
a cute little thing.
Now I can hear you smiling as you're describing it, Melody.
Yeah, I mean, I still get overwhelmed when I see how much power every person really does have. That they're probably not aware that they do have. I can see the power of my own thoughts when I tell myself I can't do something. Oh, I don't think I can do this. And the difference when I go, I believe with my higher power's help that we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the minute I take the can't out of there, my performance actually improves, measurably improves. It's all about what we really believe. Unless we're trying to do something we have no business doing, you know.
Right. Yeah, there you go. That's right. Yeah, and that's why I
wouldn't
also have
to try and operate a crane or a forklift without some proper training. We have to be sensible, too. But we're all so much more powerful than we believe we are. And we do have power to change not just ourselves, but to impact the world around us by what we think and believe about other people and ourselves.
I've learned it, and you know, through experience, that you know, my behavior and my decisions affects a lot of other people, and you know, so does my positive, you know, on purpose kind of things. It splashes all over everybody as well. So, and that sounds like what you're describing in your own life. So, what you know, the time goes so fast, Melody. I want to ask you about what you're doing today. I believe before the show. Well, I know before the show, you talked to me about you're not writing a book right now or anything. Anything you want to share with us? And you had mentioned last time you were with us a year and a half or whenever that was ago. Talk about that if you would.
Well, I know one more book I do want to write. But I've been writing books and newspaper articles and magazine articles since 1979. It's time for me to change my career. But I mean, I love writing. I love what I do.
Right.
So it's from the day I began writing, it's always been my goal to write screenplays and for TV during the last third of my career. So that's what I'm doing now. And I love it. Meant I had to, you know, you can't, the skills aren't transferable. You can't transfer book writing skills to screenplay writing skills. I had to start all over with my education to learn that. Yeah, no, they're not transferable. I've been studying this intensely the last 3 years, but for the last 7 years, I have been studying to learn this craft, and now I'm working.
I just find it extremely interesting. I mean, you said you've been writing articles, books for all those years, and you had a goal. You knew that you even said it, or I heard you say the last third or whatever your career, that you had a goal to do that and you're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I do love a good challenge. I love climbing mountains. I really enjoy it, and I have to remind myself frequently how much I enjoy that. That this isn't a problem, this is a challenge, and needing to learn the craft, being scared when I do it. When I started writing, it would take me 1 month to finish a one-page article. 1 month.
Really?
And I started bringing up an alarm clock into my office, trying to help me pick up the pace. And it did get faster. I mean, I can now do in an hour what it used to take me a month to do. So it's reasonable to expect that my first scripts will take me longer than later ones, because that's where I am at in my learning process. It's just okay. Being at peace with the events in our lives is so dang close to living in pure happiness. If we can be at peace with our life, not resign ourselves to, but just at peace with what is, it connects everything. It connects all the dots.
Well, I certainly hear that in your voice as you share yourself. You are like totally transparent, or it certainly appears that way. And, you know, from the first time I ever spoke to you, we've never met in person at all, but it's always felt like you know, like you're an old friend.
Old friend.
That's just wild how that, it's just that feeling comes over you, and it just is. So it is, you are an old friend, you know, just because that's exactly how it feels. Now, when you're talking about shifting into screenwriting, because of your immense history and the value and your proven value in writing, I mean, you may have had some doors open to you or some opportunity, or maybe not. How does that work?
The only way you can make it as a writer is on what you're doing right now with the work you have. You know, your work has to speak for you with writing. Now, I can't even say it's going to make it any... I mean, I don't even worry about that. What I worry about is writing the very best I can with the belief that when any form of my writing is good enough, it will sell.
Well, and you know, you said about the 900 copies as a goal, that book's probably sold 9 million or maybe a ton more than that.
More.
I don't know.
You certainly
shattered your goal.
But I didn't expect that. What I expected was to make myself write the very best book I could. What happens after that is out of my hands.
Yeah. Well, it's wild. I mean, you know, it must have been really reaffirming to you to know that your purpose and writing that with the passion that you did, I'm sure with all your books, but that it resonated with you're not alone, right?
Yeah, I can remember when I was in treatment, I was in a state hospital in Minnesota for 8 months, and old Doc Pete was a doctor up there then. And everyone was kind of afraid of him, and he was like the king of the state hospital campus. And I went into his office after I had been there. I was getting close to leaving, and we had a visit, and I said, I just want to be a counselor. I want to work with other addicts. And my heart broke because he looked at me and said, no, I don't think that's what you're meant to do. And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? And he said, I think you're meant to help more people than that.
Wow.
And I felt sad. I wasn't encouraged by what he said. All I could hear was, you got to do what you want.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine the life that was ahead of me back then. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone that's listening to your show right now can imagine their lives that lie ahead of them. Especially the people that are maybe new to recovery, that have created a lot of problems for themselves. We haven't lived these great lives. It's hard to imagine, but there can be a great life ahead of everyone. Truly. A great life.
Well,
and there's going to be problems there. I'm here to tell everyone, life is a series of solving problems. Don't spend so much time reacting to the fact that you have a problem that you forget to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. You know? Dig in your bag of tools, figure out what you need to do. Do you need to take action? Do you need to let go? Do you need to feel some feelings? Do you need to do a gratitude exercise? Do you need to do an inventory? Is there a behavior you need to change? You know, become a great problem solver and you'll have a great life.
Mm-hmm. huge, giant words, Melody. I mean, huge wisdom. It's just always so refreshing to hear. And, you know, a lot of these things aren't really new, but to talk about them again and the way you deliver
remind
them.
Remind ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that's why I believe I did say to you before we got on the air that I hope you maybe have the opportunity to learn something tonight as well. And that is another one of the rewards from what I found is sharing my story and what I do. I get to learn, you know, when I hear it come out of my own mouth sometimes, you know, it just reminds me again of where I'm and how really grateful I should be all the time, like all the time, because I've had a chance to live, you know, two whole lives. You know what I mean? Like, it's remarkable.
I've gotten an opportunity to live a life I didn't dream I could ever have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have no business being unhappy or ungrateful ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
you know, we hear all that stuff.
Learn negativity, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We have to unlearn it.
Yeah, and I go there too, you know. I still go there. I'm aware of it more than I ever was before, and I hope tomorrow I'll be a little more aware of that so I can change the story that I'm telling myself, all the things you talked about tonight, you know, and really try to be more useful to other people because we are all really, I believe we all really have the opportunity to get better all the time.
We do, to get better, to become happier, and then mm-hmm. again, we have the ability to create joy and happiness in our lives, no matter where we are. We all have that ability. Sometimes it's not very easy, but what do we have to lose if we create happiness for ourselves?
Well, I'll tell you, you created some happiness for me. As you were speaking, I'm just thinking, you know, really at this moment, I'd rather not be, for this past hour, I'd rather not be anywhere else. This is perfect for me. So I hope you feel some of that same thing. I'm sure the listeners will as well, you know, and do. So
yeah, I was in physical therapy this morning, and when it wrapped up, I told my therapist, I said, "Well, I said I've got to get ready. I've got to do a radio show later, and I always like quiet time before, mm-hmm. you know, before that." And she got all worried. I said, "I'm talking to an old friend tonight, and I'm talking to a group of people that are old friends.
Yeah,
even if we haven't met, you know, it's." Enjoyable and it's fun.
Well, Melody, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. We appreciate all your work. I was thinking maybe you're going to give us some hot scoop about this screenplay. You just said
I have this like superstitious belief that I don't like to talk about my work until it's done and out there because it jinxes it. So
yeah, well, that's why I didn't push too much. I respect that. Okay. Anyway, thanks so much for being with us. Again, all the best to you. Everybody loves you. Please continue to do what you do. You know, you're not going to do it because I ask you. You're doing it because it's what you're made to do. You know?
May everyone that's listening to us live the best life possible, mm-hmm. understanding that everything that happens for a reason. And somewhere in there, there's benevolency in that reason. And if we haven't found things working out for good yet, it means it's not over yet.
Thank you so much, Melody. It's been a joy.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. There you have it, Miss Melody Beattie, a wise, really nice lady with a whole bunch of experience, and she shares it just openly. You know, I called her maybe a month ago, just dialed her number. She answers the phone. I said, "Melody, would you mind coming back and sharing some of yourself with us?" She said, "Just tell me when you need me to be there. If I can help other people, that'll be just great." I love it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. It's been a real joy. I hope you got something out of the show tonight. We couldn't do it without all the guests that share with us and without the listeners as well. So thank you so much. Until next time, make it a great day.